Welcome to the By the Rivers podcast, a regular conversation on interfaith topics in the Twin Cities and beyond. I'm Rabbi Alan Shavit Lonstein, founding director of By the Rivers. We are a multi-faith learning and life cycle center in St. Paul, Minnesota. Before I begin today with our guest, I want to make sure everybody is aware we have an extraordinary learning opportunity on a riverboat on July 24th. We'll be gathering teachers and artists and look at the power of stories in our own lives and across various faith traditions. We're going to do all this while we're cruising on the Mississippi to learn and explore together. Details are at our website, bytherivers.org. I'm here today with Randy Roth. She is the Executive Director of Interfaith Action located in St. Paul. Randy, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Randy, you're new to the position at Interfaith Action, but the organization itself is not new. Tell me what it is that Interfaith Action is doing and what it has transformed from.
Sure. Well, first, Interfaith Action transformed from a Council of Churches, the St. Paul Area Council of Churches. About a year ago May, the Board of Directors voted to rename the organization Interfaith Action of Greater St. Paul and to dedicate the organization to this vision: people of faith working together to relieve the effects of poverty and address its root causes through the transformative power of thousands of volunteers. And of course, I wasn't there in the 2 years of work that led them to that moment, but the way I understand it is that as they were trying to figure out what is the best use of their financial assets, their social capital, their goodwill, was the most important thing for them to be doing. And this very smart board of directors reached the conclusion that if you live in St. Paul or the East Metro and you are a person of faith, poverty is the front burner issue that the community is facing, and they would dedicate themselves to that. And having made that decision, they didn't see a reason to keep the organization of people of faith exclusively Christian any longer, and they decided to become Interfaith and sought their first non-Christian, non-clergy executive director, which I qualified for in both counts.
Oh, it's good to be overqualified for things.
Yes.
And so where are you affiliated and what religious traditions do you bring to the work?
Yes, I am Jewish and an observant Jew, and so I bring a different tradition to this work than has ever been in this organization.
And the volunteers, are these individuals or are these churches and synagogues? How's the connection for your people?
Yes, and the answer is yes, both.
On both, okay.
Yes, yes. Many of the volunteers are individuals. Many are groups of people from one congregation with a congregational clergy representative, Jewish, Christian, and we're trying to broaden way beyond that. So I didn't answer your question about what do we do. And what we have done for a long time is run a series of what I call on-the-ground programs, programs that directly affect individuals' lives. And there are five categories of those programs in our organization. May I list them for you?
Please do, okay. And I'll make sure to have a link to on the website in our show notes.
Thank you so much. So the program that most people know us by is Project Home. This is a project that provides between 14,000 and 15,000 shelter bed nights a year in churches and synagogues throughout the East Metro. It is an emergency shelter for families in Ramsey County, families with children. And these families would have no place to go if we weren't maintaining Project Home. Project Home is staffed. We have some paid staff, a very small number of paid staff. It's largely run by an incredibly well-organized volunteer effort. So, for example, you might be a volunteer at this church or this synagogue and say, I'll take the shift from 5:30 to 8:30, or the overnight shift, or whatever it is. And so we do 40 beds a night, 20 at each of two sites. We have 24 participating congregations. And once a month, we have move day. We move the beds, the sheets, the diapers, the food, and set up shop. And that congregation gets to function in its normal way of doing business during the day, but then in the evening, it's a shelter. So that's Project Home.
And these are overflow from the established, like, Dorothy Day shelters?
Well, and Dorothy Day's for adults, not for kids. But yes, in other words, there is no other space for these families. We used to just have one tier, in other words, 12 sites, one a month. And then we move to two sites, and we always have a wait list, and every single night we turn people away.
Wow.
So that is one of our five programs. The next is, in no particular order, Project Spirit. Project Spirit is a K through 5 African-American-centered after-school program in 4 high-poverty St. Paul public schools. And with approximately 20 to 25 kids in each Project Spirit classroom. There's so many things that distinguish Project Spirit from the run-of-the-mill after-school program. First of all, the dosage. It's 3 hours a day, 5 days a week for 6 years. It has all African-American faculty so that the kids can look at the faculty as role models in their lives. Parent contact every day, 5 days a week, between the faculty and the students' parents. A very challenging academic curriculum with content rooted in African-American history and in the 7 principles of Kwanzaa. And what the kids learn is amazing in Project Spirit, and we're in the midst of a professional evaluation of Project Spirit led by Michael Quinn Patton, a very highly regarded evaluation professional who we're lucky to have living in the St. Paul community.
And so this is far beyond an after-school program that provides a safe environment for kids while their parents are still working. This has got an entirely and very focused educational piece.
That's right. This is not playtime. This is an intense time of learning. I mean, on the academic side, for example, the kids learn a 5-syllable word every day. And they have certain structured activities, and they have homework help time. But the learning around affirmations that they say in African-American history and culture content and principal content is extraordinary. We just had our first, it's a 20-year-old program, and at our breakfast last fall, a reverend, actually, a minister in our community, spoke that he was a kid in Project Spirit, and now his kid is in Project Spirit. And, he talked about how even when his kid is sick, he begs for medicine because he knows that if he doesn't go to school, his dad's not going to let him go to Project Spirit that day.
That's a good endorsement.
Yes, yes, the best. So that is Project Spirit. Third, we have the Department of Indian Work for the East Metro within our organization and in our office. And so that includes several categories of services. First, there are emergency services. Most prominently, we have the food shelf for the Native American community in the East Metro, and we have culturally appropriate indigenous foods. I think last year we distributed upwards of 65,000 pounds of food, and this year we expect to do in the 80,000 pound range. And we have the clothing equivalent of a food shelf with drives to get out, boots and coats in the winter, and other seasonally appropriate clothing distribution efforts. So that's the emergency services. We also, within the Department of Indian Work, have what we call FEDS, Family Education Diabetes Series, which is a series of evenings, 2 evenings a month, also in, I think, its 18th year, where community members in the Native community across the age spectrum, from teenagers through the elderly, come 2 evenings a month and share a meal that's been prepared by a chef who's trained in healthy cooking and diabetes management. We have several people from the University of Minnesota there. We're doing blood tests for A1C. We're doing blood pressure. We're eating this delicious meal, and the chef's talking about why it's so healthy. And then med students come in and talk about you know, let's talk about salt or let's talk about fat, whatever it is, diet issues. And then we all exercise together. And I have to tell you, I'm a pretty big exerciser. I thought I was in pretty good shape. Oh, yeah, I'm going to exercise at FADS. Ha, ha, ha. I was exhausted and my arms hurt for 2 days. So it is quite the workout. And also, finally, in the Department of Indian Work, we have a youth enrichment program, an after-school program like Project Spirit, not quite as many hours per week, at the American Indian Magnet School, again, with a culturally specific curriculum. So that's DIW, but wait, we're not done. So we have two more programs. The Interfaith Youth Connection is a program primarily for high school students of different faiths, run by Fardosa Hazan, and it works at two levels. There's a leadership level at which about 15 young people have intensive work together throughout the year, and then this culminates in a Interfaith Youth Day of Service on President's Day each year at a local college. This year it was at Hamline, where the kids study each other's religions all morning. You have Hindu 101, Buddhism 101, and they're learning. And then they go off and do a service project together in the afternoon. And then finally, our fifth project is called Farm in Faith. And we're working right now with five churches and a farmers market that we established to help recent immigrants get an economic foothold and some community rootedness through farming. And we're partners with HAP, Hmong American Partnership, in that effort.
So what impresses me about the work that you do with Interfaith Action is the comprehensive nature of it, that it's social service oriented, but it's also oriented to the big picture. There's often a charge against doing direct service work that you're just applying Band-Aids and doing, you know, rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic rather than addressing root causes. And it sounds like with the comprehensive nature of what you're doing, it's everything. You're addressing it across the spectrum and in a way that's very culturally specific, which seems important.
Thank you. Each program is culturally specific and is fully staffed by people from that culture. We're not trying to cross culture in staffing. However, we all come together for a larger effort, which is to make a serious and durable dent in poverty in the East Metro. And so I want to jump off for a second on what you just said about social service being Band-Aid. What our board of directors is interested in seeing us do is come in to accomplish the vision and the mission in two ways. And one is through on-the-ground work, which I just described to you, and the other is through a structural response to poverty in the East Metro. And what we have found over time is that programs that only do individual service, maybe over time they can get pulled down by this constant triage mentality and not see the opportunity to take full advantage of solving systemic issues. And by the same token, though, organizations that are only a think tank working on some structural thing, they can lose touch with reality and become irrelevant or wrong. But if you have both, there's a tension between them that keeps them both on track. And so that's what we're trying to be.
Is this related to the infrastructure of opportunity that you've spoken of before?
That's exactly right.
Can you elaborate on that language?
Yes. Our board was searching for the structural piece of work. The on-the-ground programs are in place, and they're great. And we read a lot, and we looked at a lot of national models for how communities are trying to organize themselves to do something broad about poverty and disparities in their communities. And this wasn't right, this wasn't right. We looked at this model, no, different things weren't working. And then we came across a book that I'm going to step back and tell you about. So there is a national nonprofit organization based in Durham, North Carolina, called MDC. And its executive director or president is a guy named David Dodson. And MDC is dedicated to creating equity and opportunity in communities. And they have been the implementers on many national foundations' multi-million dollar experiments in will this work in community, will this work in community. So they write a book every 2 years called The State of the South that looks at the South through a different lens. And in the most recent edition of State of the South, we read this. It's called Infrastructure of Opportunity. And they put out this concept that you actually can judge any place, any city, any region, on the extent to which it provides an infrastructure of opportunity for the people who live there. And after laying out what this means theoretically, they then go on in this book to assess 9 different southern cities on how are they doing. Well, they're doing well in this aspect and not so well in that aspect. And so this just rang bells for us. And we said, okay, here's what our structural response is going to be. It's in 2 parts. First is mapping. We need to know for St. Paul or East Metro, however you draw the line around the geography, 3 things. What would it take, given our demographics, for us to have an infrastructure of opportunity here? How many quality early childhood education slots would we need? How many quality K-5 after-school slots would we need at whatever level of affordability works for the families in our demographics? How much support do we need to help first-generation college students move on past high school to get a certification that has labor market value, and so on? What would it take? What do we have in place right now in St. Paul, and what's the gap? If we had those numbers, almost like a United Way thermometer for what it would take to really have opportunity in St. Paul, then we could all be aiming together to fill in the thermometer. And then the foundations in this community could say, for example, oh, we need 1,000 early childhood education slots that we don't have. I'll take 50, I'll take 100, and you could start watching as you fill in the thermometer. And the government could do that. You know, city councils might be interested, the mayor might be interested. So that's the mapping piece. And several foundations here have expressed that they are very interested in that. The second piece is how do you take this concept and make our vision come to life, which is people of faith working together to especially address the root causes of poverty. And so what we're going to do is form a core, C-O-R-P-S, like an army, of 100 volunteers, interfaith, multiracial, and intergenerational. And here's the thing about these 100 people. They're going to be people who used to say, when they had people over to dinner, or they're talking to their friends, I am just sick about poverty and disparities in my community. I read the newspaper every day, but I just do not know one useful thing I could do about it. If I knew something really useful, I would do it. That's who they used to be. Now here's who they're going to be. They're going to be people who say, I am really sick about poverty and disparities in my community, and I'm doing 2 things. First of all, I am deploying myself for 2 hours a week to the most effective work I could possibly be doing in making a difference. And second, I have dedicated myself to involvement in a learning community that meets 6 times a year and has a wealth of learning, not just information, which you know people's eyes glaze over, but real learning about how to be more and more effective in this work every month and every year. So I can explain more about how that'll work if you want, but that's the structural response.
So this infrastructure of opportunity that you're creating, it really goes both ways. You're creating opportunities for those in poverty to raise up, and you're creating opportunities for people to be able to stop just feeling frustrated and upset about it, but to actually transform and do something.
And I'd add a third, which is the community that's going to be created between the 100 people. Not that many people in their own little world have people of many different faiths and races, but these people will have that, and that's going to create yet another opportunity.
And there are opportunities for anyone to join this group.
Well, you know,
correct?
There's only going to be 100 spots, so for 200 people, the answer would be no, except perhaps this we'll do this, we'll get some results, we'll have evaluation embedded into it. If it's good, maybe someone wants to start the next 100 or the next 100. It's being designed so that it's a very inexpensive thing to do that really could be created anywhere. If you're in Willmar, make it 50 people. You know, you could do
right.
this in
It'll
many
scale.
Different ways, right? It can scale and use local expertise and resources. So what we're going to do is we're going to choose 10 nonprofit organizations that meet these four criteria. The work that they do is critical to economic opportunity. It's high quality, meaning not meaning that they spend $1 million on evaluation, but that they ask real questions about the effect they're having on the people they serve. They use volunteers for their horsepower, and they create a healthy volunteer experience. For example, perhaps the Minnesota Literacy Council will be part of that. And I understand from them that with 10 really high-quality volunteers who will go through training diligently and then teach a class one night a week, they can connect an additional 200 unemployed adults to language and then likely to employment. So you have a multiplier effect in the work of these nonprofits.
And this important work, I know David Dodson spoke at your annual meeting back in April about this very topic.
Yes, he did.
And we'll have a link to that video up on our... The work you're doing, I can see very clearly how motivating and activating volunteers and using them in very strategic ways is effective. How does the faith aspect fit into it? Is that an essential component or is that an add-on? A couple of the five programs you described are based with some faith work, but why is it important that what you're doing is an interfaith effort?
There's a lot of ways to answer that. And, you know, I will say as a predecessor statement that the work would be important even if it weren't interfaith. So the question is, what does it add that it's interfaith? It would still be worthwhile to have homeless shelters and to have food shelves.
Better question. Let's start with that one. Randy, Randy, what does it add
there
that
you
you're
go.
Doing the work
there
as an interfaith?
So, and this is just a personal answer. It's not an organizational answer. At the end of the day, everybody draws a circle around their life and says, here's who's on the inside. My family, my faith community, my friends, however you draw that circle. And everybody else is outside. I think this changes who's inside and who's outside. And it changes our concept of community. It changes our concept of the other. And you can't have blind hate where there's no longer blindness. And it helps knit us together into one community, pulling in the right direction. There's other less substantial answers. I have found that volunteers who come to the volunteer work from a place of faith motivation are the best volunteers I've ever seen in my life. They mean what they say. If they say, what do you need, and you tell them, that's what they want to do, and they're coming from such a deep place of motivation that the perseverance and follow-through and loyalty and stick-with-it-ness is at a very high level. But really, it's the integration of people from different worlds so that at the end of the work, they don't feel like they're from different worlds. They feel like we all share one world. That is the most astonishing part to me.
I've seen that last part myself, that a lot of people doing good social justice work, while it's not necessary that be done from a place of religion or faith or God or anything like that, to have the broader vision that having a faith community provides can help you when you're doing some very difficult work.
Well, and that's a very good point, because this work is not easy. None of this work is easy. And if you're not coming from a deeper place, it's hard to stick with it when the going gets tough. And when we do our learning community evenings, there'll be four portions to each learning community session, and one will be hearing from volunteers about their experiences, both good and bad. And I think that's there is not enough of an intersection between the religious community's interface with poverty and the secular community's interface with poverty. And here's what I mean. When I started the job, I met with several clergy members and, among other things, asked this question. What percentage of your time do you spend in your office with a congregant with the door closed? You're hearing about difficulties in their life, and essentially they're talking about poverty. And different clergy members gave me different answers reflective of the makeup of their congregations. And when one particular member of the clergy, Reverend Carl Walker at Morningstar Baptist Church, answered my question, he said, oh, 95%. And then we started talking about resources that are available in the community. And this changed the conversation for subsequent clergy interviews, because what we started finding, not just for Reverend Walker, but across the board, is that churches, for example, have a lot of programs to support their congregants, but might not be fully aware of the secular resources in their community. And by the same token, the nonprofit secular agencies that are trying to be useful in the lives of low-income people think of a lot of ways to do outreach, but often don't think of the church or the synagogue or the mosque.
Randy, I like to ask our guests to include a bit of learning for those listening to the podcast, some piece of text or their own tradition that inspires them. Do you have anything you can share with us today?
Yes, thank you so much. I was really honored to have the chance to participate in the opening prayer at the Dorothy Day Breakfast this year with the Archbishop, Archbishop Hebda. And so for I'm going to recap what we talked about there. So what I talked about is this. Here I was at the Dorothy Day Breakfast, but I'm Jewish. And one of the central questions that all of us have across all faiths is, how do we raise our children to grow up, to care about and work for social justice? It's one thing to talk to an adult. It's a different thing to talk to children. The Jewish people say blessings over food before we eat, and we also say or sing blessings after we eat. We call it the Birchat HaMazon. We give thanks to God for providing food for all. Near the beginning of the prayer, we talk about what God does for us. We sing happily and loudly, Hu no tein lechem lecho basar, and so on. And that line means, you give food to all living things because your kind love is always with us. But then the end of the prayer talks about how our community is caring for individuals. Listen to what it says in English. Once I was young, and now I am an old man, yet in all my days I never saw a righteous man abandoned and his children begging for bread. So how do we sing that to our kids? Although most of the song is loud and joyful, we whisper that last line almost silently, like this, Nar chayitigam, and so on. And then we pick up in a loud voice again at the beginning of the next sentence. Our kids at our dinner tables hear the song turn into a whisper for that one line and ask why, and the silence speaks louder than words. We explain to our kids that we whisper the line because it's not true and we can't say it out loud. The beginning of the prayer is true. God did create enough goodness to nourish the world. But the end of the prayer is not true. Although God created enough for everyone to be nourished, our community has not yet organized itself to make that last line true, because the righteous person is still abandoned and her children are still begging for bread. And so the question before us is, how do we as people of faith organize ourselves so that we can sing that last line out loud?
That's beautiful. Thank you for that. Thank you to Randy Roth, Executive Director of Interfaith Action, for joining us today.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure to be here.
How can people get in touch with you and the organization and volunteer?
Our website is interfaithaction.org, and there's actually a button you could click on if you want to volunteer or be in touch with us. Our email addresses are on the website.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you also to our listeners and supporters. Links to Randy's text, along with other elements and connections to the organization, are in our show notes. If you appreciate the work we do on the podcast, I ask that you support us on patreon.com/bytherivers. Here you can pledge a small amount each month to help us pay for studio time, and you'll receive recognition and gifts of appreciation. The Patreon website is patreon.com/bytherivers. For more information about By the Rivers and a list of events, workshops, and classes, visit us online at bytherivers.org. Follow us on Twitter by searching for @by_the_rivers or on Facebook. Until we chat again, may you find wisdom and challenge in the rivers that surround you.